From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Cyber warfare is the new 21st century threat, whether the aggressor is a nation state or a criminal gang. Attacks hit public infrastructure and even the federal parliament has been a target. They also disrupt businesses, educational institutions, and individuals, especially vulnerable, often elderly people. David Irvin is an expert in the cyber area. On his retirement in 2014 as head of ASIO, Irvin took on the chairmanship of what is now the Cybersecurity Cooperative Research Centre. This is funded jointly by government and the private sector. It draws together researchers from six Australian universities and the CSIRO, industry partners and government agencies. Its objective is to foster the next generation of cybersecurity talent and to develop innovative research projects to strengthen Australia's cybersecurity capabilities. Irvin recently stepped down as chairman of the centre but remains on the centre's board. His other main role is as chairman of the Foreign Investment Review Board. He joins us today to talk about cybersecurity, foreign investment, and China. David Irvin, can you give us an idea of the extent of the cyber threat, which is a shadowy one for many people, and where that threat comes from? That is, to what extent are we talking here about state actors, and to what extent is it about conventional crime through another means?
The cyber threat just grew on us as the cyber world developed. The cyber world was developed without really any concerns about security and the potential vulnerabilities that our increasing dependence on it created. And as we become more and more dependent on the internet for everything we do, for our conversations, for our business, for our work, for our defence and so on, we haven't sorted out all of the vulnerabilities that threats that presents. And so we've created dependence without protection, and now we are scrambling to put in place protections. Now, there are two main dimensions to a cyber threat, but they're actually one and the same in terms of the tools that they use and the way they go about things. You have state-based threats and you have non-state-based threats. State-based threats are the old traditional things. Cyber is just a new vector. Espionage, sabotage, covert political influencing, and so on.
State-based, of course, we're talking about governments.
Governments, exactly. But they're all forming part of what is going to be the warfare of the 21st century, which is going to be fought in cyberspace before kinetic shots are fired. And it's all part of what is increasingly being called grey warfare or hybrid warfare, where you seek to weaken your opponents and their potential for war fighting or prosperity or their political systems or whatever without kinetic shots being fired. So, and if you look at where you can in many ways most weaken your opponents, it is an attack on critical infrastructure.
Now, critical infrastructure is things like the electricity grid and...
At the moment, there are four elements to the critical infrastructure, but I think more will be added. Water, ports, energy, in its general terms, and telecommunications. And each of those is dependent to a greater or lesser degree on the cyber world. I always add a fifth. It's data. Now, data isn't a thing like a bridge or a power station, but it's what makes everything else operate. And the protection of your data from corruption, from theft, and so on and so forth, is now a hugely important issue in terms of protecting yourself against state-based attacks. And yes, there are the usual suspects that people talk about, China, Russia, but there are others who have the potential, many others, who have the potential, Iran, in North Korea, and so on. It is interesting that terrorist groups have never really exploited, as non-state actors, the potential to disrupt, destroy, discourage through cyber means. They've used cyber for proselytization, but they haven't actually been very good at turning off electricity systems or telecommunication systems, as the Russians did in Estonia in 2007, I think they did in Georgia in 2008, and so on. Now, how, as I said before, the same tools that are available to state actors are also available to non-state actors. Terrorists aside, we're talking about huge rise in cybercrime committed by organised individuals, mostly operating overseas, some in Australia possibly, who are using the theft of data, the exploitation of data, the malicious corruption of data, as in ransomware, to extract money for personal gain. And Verizon, or 5 or 6 years ago, put out some figures that projected the global cost of cybercrime rising from about $400 million in 2014 to over $6 trillion this year or next year or the year after. Now, $6 trillion is bigger than the GDP of all but two or three countries. So this is a massive issue. It's a massive issue that hits individuals, it hits companies, and we're all struggling to keep up with it. Because one of the rules in cybercrime is that the criminal is always half a step against the ahead of the protector. And just this last month, I think in Senate hearings, CEO of NAB said that his bank was suffering 100 million cyber attacks a month. ANZ said 8 to 12. Their measuring systems might be different. But this is the scale with which big business now has to deal. And it's costing them money. And it's a continuous investment for them.
So would those attacks be coming from criminal elements or from other states, or what sort of attacks are we talking about there?
More likely, they are coming from criminal elements on the banks and
yes,
so
the
on.
Banks,
but,
yes.
But not necessarily. North Korea, for example, has been known to use the profits of state-based cybercrime to help gain it foreign country currency in a time of sanctions against it.
Fairly innovative approach, at least.
Yeah, well, they're creative, that's for sure.
Now, obviously, we as a country never have enough defences, but as a country, is Australia really behind the game in its defences?
Look, I think almost every Western country is probably behind the game in its defences. If you look at Australian business, right up there at the top are the banks, because they have the greatest need to invest in cyber protection, and one hopes, because one uses banks, that they're not doing badly. One hopes that our telecommunications providers are helping protect us. But nationally, we are still, I think, we still have a long way to go. Now, having said that, it doesn't mean that governments have not been aware of the problem. In 2016, the Australian government under Malcolm Turnbull brought in a cyber strategy. It ticked all the right boxes, but left a lot to be done. That strategy was reviewed in 2020, and the government is spending, I think, $1.6 billion or whatever across the board to help implement that strategy. Within government itself, there is a tightening, but not yet complete, in my view, tightening of cyber policy in relation to protection of government information. But as we all know, state governments have been knocked over, health records have been knocked over, and so on and so forth. So it clearly means we have a long way to go. The government has also set up or invigorated the Australian Cybersecurity Centre, which is designed to help business, government, and individuals improve their cyber security. What is lacking at the moment, in my view, is a public awareness campaign. You know, I think back to the old days of HIV and the Grim Reaper, and my sense is that we actually need a very hard-hitting campaign that brings home to individuals and to businesses, and I talk to a lot of businesses in my cybersecurity role, the threat that they are under and the sort of resilience that they need to develop as individuals, as companies, and as a nation.
Are we getting the right talent into the area, or enough of the right talent, for example, through the universities?
There is a crying need worldwide for cyber talent, period, IT talent, period, and cybersecurity talent in particular. We have tried in Australia to promote that through the research centre that I'm working on. It's still really a drop in the bucket. A lot more really productive work is being done by small startup companies researching particular problems. But there continues to be a dearth of cybersecurity qualified information officers to assist companies and so on. It is a big challenge. It goes back to, you know, where we started with STEM studies. There's a huge amount of catching up that we need to do here.
Do you think that the business sector is alert enough? You've spoken about the banks and other businesses, which obviously are, but as a whole, is business aware of the threat to the extent that's needed?
Michelle, when I first joined ASIO, within a year of joining ASIO, I realised I needed an outreach program to business to advise them of the particular threats that we were seeing and that they were facing. And I got a lot of blank looks, including from the top end of town. That today has changed dramatically at the top end of town. The banks, the top 100 are beginning, the boards are beginning to be seized of the fact that cybersecurity is as important to your bottom line as every other element of your business, and that it requires constant investment. Where I think there still is a problem is that people are still not sure where to go for help. There's a lot of cyber snake oil salesmen out there, you know, and they need to get the right sort of help. Boards need to be able to ask the right sort of questions of their CEOs and so on. And then further down the line, small business needs a lot of help, because a lot of cyber attacks are directed through small businesses. A medical practice, for example, that is not using its computer overnight is a wonderful place for someone to jump in there and start attacking all over the place and getting off the network in the morning, for example. But small businesses, businesses which are subject to ransomware attacks, they need to be a lot better informed, and they need to be a lot better equipped to be able to handle attacks. And then the final thing is, you know, we talk about state-based attacks, we talk about criminal attacks. Most cybersecurity breaches occur inside the house. They occur because your personnel push the wrong buttons, respond to the sham emails or whatever. There is not yet enough cybersecurity awareness in across the board in small business, middle business, and so on.
And what about individuals, Mr. and Mrs. Parramatta, who are subject to a scam? These people are left to fend for themselves?
There are now areas where they can go for help. Reporting the attack, perhaps not to the Australian Cybersecurity Centre, but there are 24/7 help desks available run by the authorities that will help them through it. Doesn't mean they always get their money back. I think the banks generally have been relatively sympathetic to assisting people who've been scammed, and I hope they will continue to be so, but they can't be recklessly sympathetic either.
Just before we move off this topic, the campaign you're talking about, the awareness campaign, that needs to be run obviously by the federal government.
I would think so. Properly targeted, simple, clear, helpful.
Well, we are pre-budget, so you could send a message. Send a message to Josh.
We've just had a few precedents recently that...
Let's just turn to foreign investment and the way attitudes have changed over the years. If we think back a few decades, the cry was we needed to buy back the farm or at least not sell the farm. And then the attention was very much on the need for getting capital from overseas as much as we could, really. How would you define, just in broad guiding principles, where the balance now lies in your thinking as chair of the Foreign Investment Review Board?
You know, for ever since 1788 and probably even before then, Australia has actually been dependent on foreign investment for its development. And that situation hasn't changed. It's become a lot more sophisticated in its nuances and all the rest of it. But essentially, foreign investment today accounts for about 4% of GDP. And we need it. We need it to promote employment. We need it to promote development. We need it to promote productivity. We need it to promote national wealth. And foreign investment in that sense, if you think of all the investment in the resources sectors and so on and so forth, has really assisted Australia enormously. Now, there will always be sections of the community that remain concerned that we are selling off the farm, literally in some cases. But in fact, the amount of agricultural land held by foreign interests hasn't actually changed much in the last few years. So the starting point is I think Australia will continue to need foreign investment, and it continues therefore to need to be an attractive place for foreign investment. And we are. We're stable. We have the rule of law. You know, you can rely on the sorts of economic factors governing, risk factors governing your investment, and that makes us essentially a good place to invest. And our economy is still growing, even in the pandemic. What has changed more recently, however, has been the need for governments to look much more closely at investment in areas of critical national security and critical infrastructure. Now, we always did that in the past. But more recently, with the cyber world developing the way it is, the technological world developing the way it is, governments have introduced changes to the investment legislation to enable it to take a more careful look at certain forms of investment. Now, overall, national security investments affecting national security, really only affect a tiny percentage. Now, we've regulated investment before. We currently have regulations about whether foreigners can buy established housing. They can buy new stock, but not established housing. And that was in response to community attitudes and community needs.
Now, you, in a very varied career, you've also been a diplomat and ambassador to China. Do you think the tensions between Australia and China will inevitably just worsen in the coming decade?
It is very hard to say. My own view is that we are going through a really rough patch where a country that is basing its is protecting its national interest is coming up against a country which is promoting its national interests in a very aggressive way. My own expectation is that the Australia-China relationship will eventually find a level. It won't be the same as when bright-eyed and bushy-tailed in the early 80s we rushed off to China to help develop a massive relationship. It won't be the same in texture or in tone, but it will, and it will be based much more on a recognised mutual self-interest. between the countries. And there is and remains considerable mutual interest. Chinese investors, albeit having reduced their investments in Australia in recent years, are still continuing to invest here. We are still continuing to do trade in areas. My sense that a balance of interests will eventually establish itself. There might be some rough travelling along the way, and there'll certainly be some pretty rough language used, which interests me from a point of view of, you know, diplomatic speak. But my sense is that, yes, we will have some bumpy times, and we have been having some bumpy times, we will find a balance because it's in the interests of both countries to do so.
Well, talking of rough language, the Secretary of the Department of Home Affairs, Mike Pezzullo, this week has said he's hearing the sounds of the drums of war. Do you hear them too?
There's a lot of cacophony out there. And we're talking about a whole range of possibilities. I personally think that there will always be potential for kinetic clashes in our region, over Taiwan, over the South China Sea, over Korea, and so on. And we've actually lived with that for decades. Now, the noises might be a little louder at the moment, but we lived through them all in the past through the old-style Cold War.
Well, of course, sometimes they came to hot wars.
But not all that. Not necessarily directly between the great powers.
No.
And therefore... But, look, I'm an optimist. I believe that it is possible for two great powers like China and the US to manage their competition, and it is competition, and it's serious competition, while also taking into account the security and the interests of other regional countries. For a while, in the past 20 years, we have focused on sort of developing regional architecture to manage those sorts of issues, the ASEAN Plus meetings, ASEAN Defence, and all that sort of thing. Most of those are, in fact, centred on ASEAN. There may be scope in due course to revive some of those. They're all a bit more abundant at the moment. But ultimately, I think we depend on China and the United States developing a modus vivendi, which concedes some interests but protects others. Because the alternative is really too horrendous to contemplate. You have two nuclear-armed powers, each with the capability of knocking each other out, and a lot of other countries along the way.
David Irvin, thank you very much for sharing your insights today. And that's all for today's Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Tom Glassie. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.